The flag officer was Captain Rutherford, Tulvern added, and there was some sort of incident. The Froom took a few shots, the fleet returned fire, and soon it was an all-out battle. When the Froom had been destroyed, Rutherford bombarded enemy positions on the surface.
"That must be where those four ships are jumping," Tulvern said. "They're off to San Pablo to join Rutherford."
"Perhaps. I'd only expect additional Albionish forces if the Froom Empire was escalating the conflict."
"Why the devil would the Froom be stupid enough to start another fight?" she asked.
"What makes you think they did?"
Drake grabbed for the towel to dry his hair. "Right now I'd assume that every last thing coming out of the fleet contained some falsehood or other."
"So it's a trap? They know we're here and want us to think they're preoccupied."
"I'm prepared for anything right now, Commander. Dreadnought herself might be lurking in orbit around Hart Barsa, heavily cloaked and waiting."
"So what do we do?"
"The same thing we were going to do all along. We assume that our plans remain a secret, that Malthorn doesn't believe we'd be stupid enough to attack the planet with a single ship, that he doesn't know that we want to get our hands on the sugar antidote in the first place."
"I'm struggling to understand that myself, sir."
"Good, then the Admiral will surely be caught unawares, and that's why I'm not expecting Dreadnought, or anyone else but one puny little destroyer. Plus the orbital fortresses, of course, but no need to point out this minor obstacle." He dried his left ear and tucked in his comlink. "Jane, how far are we from Hart Barsa?"
Jane's cool voice came through.
32 hours and 15 minutes.
Drake smiled at Tulvern.
"Barely half a billion miles to go. Another few hours undetected, and it will be too late for anyone to stop us. We'll drop down, grab the goods, and make a run for it. Head for the hills, as they say."
"Just like that, sir."
"Just like that."
"I trust you," she said.
"Good. Smythe and Barker were supposed to build a simulation of how this ship will perform in battle, given how we've messed around with her. Go up to the bridge, and I'll join you in a few minutes. It's time to see what Blackbeard can do."
"Yes, sir."
Drake waited until Tulvern was gone, then went to his closet to retrieve his vest. When he finished buttoning it, he studied himself in the bathroom mirror. At first glance, he looked every inch an officer of the Royal Navy, but something seemed to be different about the expression on his face. Something untrustworthy in his eyes. Of course he was imagining it. There was no such change, but he couldn't shake the impression. Tulvern had been agitated about the news coming out of the Navy and worried about the upcoming mission to Hart Barsa. It must seem to her a final, irrevocable step. But Drake knew she was wrong. That step had already been taken. From fleeing with Ajax, to attacking the slave galleon, to battling Rutherford, and finally altering his ship in the San Pablo yards. Every action he'd taken had only cemented a decision made the moment he refused to surrender after his crew mutinied. No, that wasn't it. You took the final step when you attacked Captain Vargas. That's when you took yourself beyond the law. Of course, everything else had been a reaction, defensive, an attempt to clear his name and protect his crew. But Vargas, pirate or no, hadn't done anything to provoke him. Well, there was nothing to do now but face up to his new responsibilities. And so Drake straightened his captain's bars, steeled himself for the hard work ahead, and made his way to the bridge.
This is the end of Starship Blackbeard, Book 1 of the Starship Blackbeard series. The story continues now with Book 2 of the Starship Blackbeard series, Lords of Space.
Chapter 1. Henny Cap lay in bed, counting the minutes until Carvalho arrived. She knew he'd be tired after getting off shift, as he'd spent 10 straight hours on a spacewalk
while he and his fellow engineers worked outside in the vacuum to repair a problem with the new shields. They weren't retracting properly, which made it impossible to deploy the underside battery. Carvalho would come to her room, wanting to collapse. Cap didn't care how exhausted he was. She was horny, and she meant to get some before she let him sleep a wink. If he didn't come to her straight away, she'd threatened, she'd hunt him down in the crew berths and drag him out by his stones. This was the first night ever that Cap would enjoy a private berth, and she meant to put it to good use, a perk of her promotion to officer. The room was cramped, it was true, barely long enough for her cot and a toilet. She was a lowly ensign, after all, and didn't have so much as her own shower, but it was quiet and private. No more hot bunking, where you showed up in the crew quarters just as the previous bloke rolled out of bed, climbed into bed to find the mattress still warm, the sheets carrying some jerk's sweat and body odor, others snoring above and below, coughing, farting, talking in their sleep, tossing and turning, and doing every other imaginable thing to annoy and aggravate. As for hooking up with a fellow crew member, forget it. Cap and Carvalho made love anywhere they could steal a moment of privacy, engineering closets, an away pod, even inside an empty torpedo tube. Technically, so-called fraternizing was against regulations, but even Captain Drake had lightened up since leaving the space yards of San Pablo. Hard not to, them being fugitives and all, their crew rounded out with pirates and smugglers. The clock showed 0515. He'd sent a message swearing he'd be off by 0500. So where the devil was he? Cap was on the verge of springing up and grabbing her jumpsuit to go track him down in the crew berths when a light tap sounded on her door.
"That you?"
she asked. "Who else would it be?"
"Better be," she said. "I'm naked and ready to jump the first bloke I see."
His sigh was audible through the door. Cap grunted. This might be harder than expected. She didn't bother to cover herself with the blanket as the door slid open and Carvalho slipped inside. The hall light showed streaks of grease across his cheeks and his eyes were bloodshot. Then he was inside and the door closed, leaving them in the dim light of her bedside lamp.
"It is you, love," she said with a smile. "You kept me waiting so long I didn't much care any more. Another 20 minutes and I would have reached into the hall and grabbed the first warm body I could find."
Carvalho sat on the edge of the bed, barely looking at her as he yanked off his boots.
"It's a mess out there. Captain was right. We left San Pablo too fast. Should have stuck around the yards a few more days, making sure everything was in order. Lot easier than working the repairs out here."
"Stick around and get blasted by the Royal Navy? No thanks. You heard Rutherford is bombarding San Pablo, right? That's us he's trying to kill."
"Scoot over," Carvalho said.
"No room, you'll have to lie on top of me."
She reached a hand down between his legs.
"Got something down there for me, love? How about you let me have a look?"
Carvalho took her hand and pulled it away.
"Come on, Cap, I'm knackered."
"You don't seem that tired to me."
"And you know what else?"
"What?"
He started to say something, then stopped himself.
"Look, I shouldn't have come."
"What's this all about?"
"I don't want to talk about it."
"You're not that deep, love, so don't go pretending you're keeping secrets and whatnot."
Carvalho grunted. He was still sitting up, and strangely, he really did seem to have something eating at him. That was new and unwelcome. If Cap wanted some bloke who needed to pour his heart out with angsty crap, she wouldn't be with Carvalho. But she supposed it wouldn't hurt to listen, so long as he didn't make a habit of it.
"You can tell me why you take your clothes off," she said.
"Don't you think about anything else?"
"When I haven't seen you in 36 hours? No, not really,"
she pouted.
"I ain't fooling around here, and I know you're plenty capable, unless you've been dipping your oar in other waters."
"I haven't, and you know it."
"Yeah, I know. And I don't much care anyhow, so long as you keep enough for me."
Her hands worked at his jumpsuit while she spoke. She unzipped it and peeled it off his broad, muscular shoulders. She trailed her fingernails down his chest with one hand while she worked the suit off him with the other. As she told him, he really wasn't that complex, and he was soon doing what she wanted him to. But he seemed distracted, and she had to do most of the work. It wasn't the best lovemaking, that was for bloody sure, but it sufficed for her needs. Later, as she lay on top of him, her head against his shoulder, drifting to sleep, he cleared his throat.
"You know what Vargas gave them on Captain Kidd?" he said. "Half for the officers and half for the crew. Then the crew divvied up the loot however they wanted. Guy gets injured, they give him a double share. Loses an eye or a limb, they double it again."
"Where'd you hear that?" she asked.
Carvalho rested one of his hands on her butt and rubbed the other idly over her freshly buzzed scalp.
"Common knowledge. That's the way pirates work."
"Well, we ain't pirates, so we'll do whatever Captain Drake decides. You heard what he said."
"All those guys didn't join us in San Pablo so they could earn Navy wages. What's that, £2 a week for an enlisted man like me?"
"Too light for that now. 20 hours and we'll be in battle. Let's get in and out of there alive before we start bellyaching about pay."
"It'll be too late then."
"King's balls, will you leave it alone? I ain't got no choice now, not here in the void with half the damn Navy searching for us."
"We got a choice. A big one."
"What the devil are you talking about?" she said.
"Oh, forget it. I'm going to grab some shut-eye. Things will look better in the morning, I'm sure."
Cap pushed herself up. She'd shut off the light after they finished their lovemaking, but now turned it on again.
"Spit it out. What are you going on about?"
"Never mind."
She slapped a hand against his chest.
"Enough of that crap. What's this all about? And where did you get that stuff about how Vargas paid his crew? We killed that bastard at the yards, wiped out most of the rest of them, too."
"Didn't kill his daughter."
Cap frowned, thinking of the dark-haired, flashing-eyed daughter of the pirate captain.
"Katerina Vargas."
"She sent me a message. A couple of days ago, right after we shoved off."
"King's balls. And you didn't tell me? And what's she got to offer, anyway? Her daddy's ship was stripped for spare parts. She's nothing without a ship, just another gun for hire."
"What if we say, for the sake of argument, that she had her own ship? That sometimes she flew with her old man, and other times she set off on her own?"
"Now you're just making stuff up," Cap accused.
"Fine, whatever. Believe what you want."
"And what does she want, revenge?"
"Not exactly."
"Well then?"
He shook his head.
"Like I said, forget it. You're in a mood. And I've decided to settle for £2 a week till I see how things shake out."
"Damn it, Carvalho, will you tell me?"
"Forget it. I know how you're sweet on him."
"For the captain?" she scoffed. "What a bloody fool you are. Let Tolvan pine after Drake. I ain't at all keen on him."
"How am I supposed to tell otherwise the way you're talking about him all the time?"
Carvalho said sullenly.
"It's called loyalty, you idiot. Drake gave me a chance as pilot. Weren't nobody else who did that. Could have shoved me off on San Pablo, or when he got back that room. But he didn't. You should be feeling something yourself. If it weren't for the captain, we'd both be in the mines.
And I pulled his stones out of the fire on San Pablo. So that makes us even. Except I'm getting £2 a week, while he takes what he wants. Anyway, I don't believe you. I think you are keen on him. That's what all that needling of Tolvern is about. You're telling the commander what you're really feeling yourself."
"Ha!"
Cap didn't know if she should be impressed that Carvalho was actually thinking about stuff a little deeper than usual, or annoyed that he was so wrong about her feelings for the captain. Cap was the sort of woman who knew exactly what she did and didn't want, and if she'd been hot for the captain, she wouldn't have been pining hopelessly for him like Jess Tolvern was. She'd have done something about it.
"Are you jealous?"
she asked.
"Is that what this is about?"
"Hell no."
"You are, aren't you? Listen to me. Drake is the son of a baron. He's a stiff, upper-class son of a bitch. That's pretty much the opposite of what I want, and that's the bleeding truth. Now what's this about Katerina Vargas? What did she tell you? What does she want?"
"Nope, I'm not talking about it anymore."
He thrust out his chin and narrowed his eyes. She'd seen that stubborn look before and knew he meant business, but she had no intention of letting it go herself, either. Cap started to press on, only to be interrupted by the chime of her clock, warning that she was shortly expected on the bridge. Was it that late already?
Good, Carvalho said as she climbed out of bed. He pulled up the blanket and made a show of rolling over to face the wall. Now maybe you'll let me sleep.
Did you send Katerina Vargas a return message? She asked. Look at me, did you?
Not yet, but I'm thinking about it.
Don't you dare. I'm serious. We're going into battle, and the last thing we need is that pirate wench knowing where we are. Who knows what she'd do or who she'd tell?
He looked troubled at this, and this only deepened her suspicions.
You didn't, did you? Because if she knows that we're on our way to Hot Pasa, and the fleet were to somehow find out...
Why would she tell anyone? She's not exactly on friendly terms with Albion herself. Her old man shot up a Royal Navy cruiser.
Oh, I don't know,
Cap said, as she pulled on her underwear and grabbed for her jumpsuit where it lay, crumpled in a pile.
How about, hey, Captain Rutherford, give me 1,000 guineas and I'll tell you where you can find Drake and the rest of the fugitives. Katerina Vargas gets her revenge and a nice payoff at the same time.
I didn't tell her.
Cap studied him as she zipped up her jumpsuit and swatted at the worst of the wrinkles before picking up her socks and shoes.
You better be telling the truth.
Her comlink opened. It was the captain.
Are you up, Ensign?
I'll be there in 10 minutes.
Make it 2. We've got a situation.
Yes, sir.
The line went dead, and she turned back to Carvalho with a scowl.
I am telling the truth, he insisted. Now get going. Forget I said anything.
You keep saying that, Cap muttered as she slipped out of the room.
The corridor was empty, which was good. It wasn't exactly a secret that Carvalho would be sleeping in her room, but she didn't want to make a spectacle of it either.
Blasted Carvalho.
Now he'd put her in an awkward position. Should she tell Drake and Tolvern what he'd said about Katerina Vargas or not? It was a favor Drake had done her, and make no mistake. Once the captain had his precious room pilot back, out of detox for his sugar addiction, what did he need her for? She could navigate about 5 jump points, and another 8 or 10 with some difficulty. Using great concentration, she could interface her nav chip with the nav computer and maneuver the ship around any given star system. But compared to Nib Pym, her piloting skills were rubbish. Not to mention that she could barely read and write, which had been displayed to humiliating effect when the captain insisted that she write up the specifications of a jump point. Cap was the daughter of a stevedore in the York Space Yards and a barmaid. Her type didn't get much schooling as a general rule. The captain didn't need much more excuse to dump her at the first opportunity and pick up someone better as Nib Pym's sub-pilot. She didn't want to give him another reason to doubt her. By the time Cap got to the bridge, she decided. Probably Carvalho had nothing. Katerina Vargas must have got her hands on a new ship, probably some crappy little tramp frigate outfitted with a deck gun or two. The woman had sent Carvalho, and a bunch of other riffraff, no doubt, a message asking if he wanted to join her new crew, made all sorts of promises about treasure and the like, trying to raise a crew on swagger and wishful thinking. If Cap told Drake, it would amount to nothing except to remind the captain that she herself was of the same lowly origins as Carvalho and the rest of the scum they'd scraped up in San Pablo. And so, when she came onto the bridge, she made her way to the pilot's chair without saying a word to the captain, the commander, or anyone else about what she'd heard about Katerina Vargas. Chapter 2 Drake glanced up as Cap came slinking onto the bridge. Her clothing was rumpled, and she had the look of someone who had rolled out of bed 3 minutes earlier. He could see Commander Tolvern scowling as she looked over the sub-pilot's disheveled appearance and hoped that Tolvern would mention it to her the next time they were alone. The two women had gotten off to a rocky start, but seemed to be forming an unusual friendship since their time on San Pablo. Cap toggled screens on the nav computer. She looked distracted, didn't seem to understand yet why he'd called her to the bridge early. Drake wondered which he'd noticed first, the missing pilot on the bridge or the minefield they were approaching at nearly 4,000 miles per second. He turned back to his terminal, where he'd been reading Barker's latest report about fixing the shield retractors.
"What's this red thing you were coming up on?"
Cap asked at last.
"About time," Tolvern said. "Thought maybe we'd blast right through it before you noticed."
"So what is it, sensors or something?"
Tech Officer Smythe looked up from his own terminal.
"That red thingy is an array of Yude mines."
"What's a Yude mine, Captain?"
Drake was glad neither he nor the commander had mentioned Cap's slovenly uniform, as it appeared there were more critical deficiencies to correct in the recently promoted subpilot.
"Didn't you read your briefing?"
"What briefing?"
Drake sighed and turned to Tolvern.
"Commander."
Tolvern looked peeved.
"Aren't you reading your memos?"
Cap looked back and forth between the three others on the bridge, before finally returning her gaze to the commander.
"I was off shift." "Off shift isn't the same as offline," Tolvern said. "You're supposed to check your memos and briefings. Even when I'm sleeping?" "You set an alarm. You wake up and check your messages midway through. We're only a few hours out from battle, or worse, if you don't get us through these mines."
"But where is Nib Pim?"
Cap sounded almost desperate.
"Why can't he do it?"
"He's in detox with the Shakes," Drake said.
Now she understood, but her reaction wasn't inspiring confidence.
"Again? Did he get hold of some sugar or something?"
"He might be in and out for weeks. Anything he can give us I have to save for Hot Barca itself. That means I need my sub-pilot, that is to say, you, to get us through this minefield."
Jane's calm computer voice helpfully chimed in.
30 minutes to minefield. At present course, 19 Class 2 detonations expected."
"Then it's a good thing we're not taking the current course, isn't it?" Drake said, still staring at Cap.
She started to respond, but Barker came through on the comlink, asking if Drake could come down to engineering. Barker had a possible fix to the shield retractor that would allow them to use the newly installed battery of cannons on the belly. No, Drake said he could not right now.
"What about those mines?"
Cap asked when he'd ended the call.
"I don't even know what a Yude mine is. Isn't anyone going to tell me?"
Drake forced himself to remain calm. "Tolvern, take the helm. Cap, come with me to the war room."
"Alone, sir?"
Cap asked.
"Yes, alone, and be quick about it. I don't have time to waste."
To Tolvern, he said, "Keep us on course until we're back. We won't be long."
"Better not be," Tolvern muttered.
Once the doors had closed on the war room, Drake told Cap to take a seat before sitting down himself. He fought to hide his frustration as he looked at the young woman, anxiously rubbing the lion tattoos on her arm. For the 100th time in the past several weeks, he bemoaned the loss of his Navy crew. Except for Tolvern, Smythe, Barker, and a few others, he was left with these former prisoners and newly recruited pirates and smugglers. How in the blazes was he going to run the orbital forts around Hot Barca, let alone lead an assault team on Admiral Malthorn's estate, with a crew such as this?
"You did fine in actual battle, Ensign. This is nothing, just a minefield."
"But what's a Yude mine? What does that mean?"
"It doesn't mean anything. It's just a name, a Navy classification. When a Yude mine detects you, it sends a signal to all the others in the cluster, and the whole minefield gives chase. That's what Jane meant about 19 detonations against the hull."
"Wouldn't 19 Class 2 detonations tear us to pieces?"
"Sure, if we were foolhardy enough to stumble through and let them pummel us. We aren't. We picked up the field with long-range sensors, and know exactly where they are. We're still several million miles away. If I didn't think you could bring us through safely, I'd have turned us around already and looked for some safer approach to the inner worlds of the system. So you see, I'm not worried."
At this, Cap calmed down a little.
"Yeah, I guess that's right. Sorry. I ain't so sure of myself at the moment.
There was still something in her tone that made him hesitate. Are we good?
Will Nib Pym be okay?
I'm sure he will. He suffered a relapse, is all. I don't mean he got his hands on sugar, so you don't need to worry about that. But he started shaking in his chair a couple of hours ago. I sent him to the sick bay as a precaution. This was all true. The Hroom had turned violent during the worst of his withdrawal, and Drake hadn't wanted to chance another incident. Apart from that, he needed Nib Pym at his sharpest, most able, as they approached the planet.
Good, because I don't think I can hack it on my own.
You managed quite well before we recovered him from the slaver, Drake pointed out. Piloting solo, you seemed quite confident. Tolvan would even say you were cocky. Where has that woman gone? I need her back.
I don't know what's wrong. Cap rubbed a hand over her scalp. Maybe it's 'cause nobody expected much. And now they do.
She tapped her chest, where the ensign insignia was sewn onto her jumpsuit.
Or maybe it's this gold bar you gave me. I'm an officer now. It's kind of crazy, know what I mean?
A junior officer, he said with a smile. You have plenty of time to grow into the position, Cap.
Okay. I'm feeling better now.
There's one other thing. As soon as we run the forts, we're bringing Ajax, excuse me, Blackbeard, to the surface. Drake stopped, uncertain as to how much he should reveal.
Aye, Captain?
He thought about what Tolvern would say if she knew what he planned to do with Cap when they reached Hot Barsa. Tolvern would be alarmed, beyond alarmed, and maybe she'd be right. If Drake trusted any of the newer crew members, that trust was thinner than the hair on Lord Malthorn's bald spot. Never mind, he said. Let's get through that minefield first. Commander Tolvern gave him a questioning look as Drake and Cap emerged from the war room onto the bridge. He returned a shake of the head to say that now was not the time. Instead, he settled in the captain's chair and watched as Cap sat and interfaced with the nav computer. She looked more confident now.
10 minutes to minefield, Jane helpfully notified him. At present course,
he tapped his console to cut her off. Since we're changing course, that isn't helpful. Nobody else spoke as Cap worked. Drake quietly ran his own calculations and picked out an alternative that would scoot them along the edge of the minefield. With any luck, they'd survive the encounter, but he wasn't confident with what he saw. Cap had better find a safe course and hurry up about it, too. Drake hadn't known exactly where to find the minefield, only that it was somewhere between Hot Barsa and her ice-covered twin, Cold Barsa. Because the Barsa system had so many jump points, it had been impossible for the Navy to guard all of the approaches to the inner worlds with ships from the fleet. So a few lanes were marked safe for the merchant fleet, and everything else was declared a minefield, whether there were mines or not. Now that Captain Rutherford's task force had renewed the fight with the aliens, the minefield would be active again. Cap looked up with about 5 minutes to spare.
Got it!
She sent over her proposed course. It showed Blackbeard zigzagging through, never coming close enough to any of the Ewed mines to trigger their swarming behavior.
Excellent. Commander, verify and plot that course.
Tolvern's fingers flew over her console. Shortly the minefield came within range of the ship's short-range scanners, and Drake brought up the viewscreen to focus on the nearest mine. It was only a few 100,000 miles distant. It wasn't until he filtered the bright white light of the system's young star blazing off port that he could actually see the thing, lurking quiet and deadly. The mine had the fractal shape of a giant snowflake, about 70 feet from point to point, and sat motionless in space so as to render its profile nearly invisible. Beneath that motionless exterior lay a deadly array of instruments, plasma engines for giving pursuit, an explosive stinger powerful enough to rip a small hole through the armor of a Hroom sloop of war, or a modified Royal Navy cruiser like the one Drake was flying.
Course plotted, Tolvern said.
Jane?
Drake asked the computer, wanting verification.
Estimated collisions with the upcoming minefield?
Probability of one or more collisions, 5.6%. Probability of three or more collisions, 1.3%. Probability of five or more collisions. Calculating.
Jane was silent for a long moment.
Less than 0.2%. Unknown factors include...
I'd rather have zero, Drake said as he cut Jane off once more. But given the circumstances, I'll take those odds. Drake called down to engineering to help Barker understand the instructions he'd be receiving about powering up and down the second plasma engine as they danced their way through. Moments later, Blackbeard dropped several hundred miles per second as she cut sharply on the Z-axis. Then they hooked starboard to thread another needle between the sensors of two more mines. Next came a sharp yaw to the left, followed by an aggressive change to their pitch, until they appeared to be diving straight down relative to their previous course, even though this took them further away from Hot Barca. The floor vibrated during the sharpest course corrections as the antigrav shifted to compensate. The perspective spiraled through the viewscreen until the stars looked like they were swirling down a vast interstellar toilet bowl. When Blackbeard finally straightened out, the system's white-yellow star blazed off port once more. They'd successfully waltzed their way through, as graceful on their feet as Drake's sister trying to catch the eye of a rich earl at the king's ball. The image gave him a warm, nostalgic glow. Why had he been thinking about his family? It was almost Michaelmas, he supposed, a time when he'd always tried to get leave so he could return to the family estate. They always ate goose, and he smiled to think of how his younger sister, Helen, used to sneak down to the kitchen to get at the fruitcakes before they were served. He would take both of his sisters duck hunting at the lakes, and whatever they shot, they would give to the peasants of the estate. Not this year.
We did it, Drake said. No pursuit. We got through unscathed.
Not entirely, sir, Smythe said. The tech officer kept working at his computer. Our wake seems to have washed over those last couple of mines.
You're sure?
Drake asked sharply. Pretty sure, yeah. The way we were going, our engines were like two big fire hoses blasting this way and that. Do that as long as we did, and stuff is likely to get wet.
I see.
Assuming they were scanning for such a thing, Tolvern said. Were they, Smythe?
Yes, sir, Smythe said. He tapped his fingers over his console. That's how I found the minefield in the first place. They were hammering away with active subspace scanners.
I didn't think about getting detected, Cap said. Maybe I could have tried something else.
We had no time for that, Drake said. Anyway, what's done is done. He glanced back at the commander, who was chewing on her lip. So they've sent a warning to the fleet, he continued. Maybe they identified us from our wake, maybe not. But either way, the Navy knows something is headed toward Hont Barca, something that doesn't want to be seen.
The forts will be on alert, Tolvern said. And the destroyer will have its guns ready.
We knew that already, what with Rutherford stirring up the room again. It's the other royal ships lurking in the system that worry me. Jane, Drake queried, how long to Hot Barca at our current course and speed?
Calculating. 12.4 hours.
That long? He'd been thinking closer to 11. Either way, it was too long. In addition to travel time, he needed several hours for the assault itself, and more time to make a clean getaway. Tolvern, get Barker on the comm. I want us accelerating to maximum speed. Drop cloaking. Just hit that throttle with everything we've got. At this point, if we're spotted, it almost doesn't matter. He rose to his feet.
Where are you going? Tolvern asked.
To engineering. It's time to see about that new battery. At this point, it's either working or it's not. We have no more time to mess around. We're going into battle. Chapter 3 Blackbeard came blistering toward Hot Barca at nearly 10% the speed of light. From a distance, the planet was a speck of light, not much bigger than the background stars, except that being much closer, it moved across the viewscreen as they hooked wide to come down over the North Pole, and what Drake had determined was the weakest of the planet's six orbital fortresses. but at this speed they would flash by Hot Barca like a bullet zipping past a man's head. Drake had to brake, and brake hard, to get them to slow down enough to descend through the planet's thick atmosphere. Drop from 10% the speed of light to 1%, then to a few thousand miles an hour, and they'd expose themselves to punishing attack for an unacceptable length of time. So, he only ordered them to slow when they were 2 minutes from the planet. They'd only shed a fraction of their speed as they blew past the world several tens of thousands of miles outside the atmosphere, but Drake was curving sharply to port at the same time, and a few minutes later, Blackbeard came screaming around in orbit like a distant satellite. Nib Pym sat in the pilot's chair, with Cap next to him, working the nav computer in support. The room was all concentration now, suffering none of the shakes that had been troubling him. He threaded them expertly through a path that only gave the orbital fortresses a split second to attack, before Blackbeard had zipped past again. The enemy didn't even try to hit them at first. But on the third pass, Blackbeard had slowed enough that the first of the orbital fortresses opened fire. During its orbits, the ship came in view of four of the six at one point or another, and all of them started shooting by the fourth time around. The two biggest delivered the biggest punch. These had been built into the side of Hot Barca's two small moons. Themselves captured asteroids the shape of 10-mile-long baked potatoes, and presented formidable arrays of cannon, torpedo, and missile batteries. Soon, dozens of projectiles were flying out, and missiles and torpedoes came corkscrewing after the renegade ship. Drake had been studying the calculations coming through from Cap. "Mark this course," he told his pilots, and gave coordinates.
"Confirm heading," Nib Pym said.
It was rare for the Hroom to question Drake's orders, but he seemed to have correctly deduced that such a course would take them back toward deep space.
"You heard me. 12 seconds on that course, then reverse to bring us around. Keep with present deceleration. Remember Epis 3.
"Yes, of course."
The Hroom would be understanding now why Drake had given the order. The captain had used this same tactic during the war, while coming between two poorly coordinated Hroom fleets that had ended up doing each other more damage than they'd done Drake's task force. Too much ordnance in play at once, directed by too many competing fire control systems. Nib Pym had been Drake's pilot for that battle. He executed the maneuver even better this time. They'd evaded most of the enemy fire by the time they came back around. What didn't blow itself up either lost itself to their rear or was brought down by Barker's chaff and other countermeasures. Only two small kinetic cannon blasts hit the ship, and the shields shrugged them off, with minimal damage. Still, there were several tense minutes during the final approach, when they came down atop the North Pole. The Polar Fortress spotted them, and brought out its main guns as they came toward it. Blackbeard was traveling much slower now, and the fort seemed to have all the time in the world as the ship continued to decelerate, in preparation for entering Hot Barca's atmosphere. The Polar Fort was supposed to be the smallest of the six in orbit around the planet, but on the viewscreen it seemed massive and deadly. The fort commander could boast double the guns of the starship and an endless supply of torpedoes and missiles compared to Drake's. In addition, its batteries and bomb-proofs burrowed into the side of a small captured asteroid with hundreds of feet of protective rock, making it look almost impregnable, like a mile-long tortoise with guns. Against it, Drake had a couple of feet of pterillium armor. He could not afford to stand off a pace and slug it out with that beast. The mood on the bridge was tense, silent, as lights flared along the side of the fort, its weapons discharging. Drake called the gunnery.
"Hold the broadside. Give her the secondary battery."
"Aye, sir,"
Barker said. He delivered it in his customary growl, but Drake heard the quaver in his voice.
"Those guns had better work," Drake muttered to himself.
They'd left San Pablo last week after a rushed job in Hubert Rodriguez's space yard. Rodriguez was skilled and reliable, and had helped fight off a pirate attack attempting to seize the ship and kill its crew. He'd incorporated the shields and batteries of Captain Kidd, a pirate vessel Drake and his crew had trashed in battle, into HMS Ajax. The ship had left San Pablo rechristened as Blackbeard, more formidable than ever. But they'd left in a rush to get away before Rutherford's naval forces arrived to crush them. The urgency had come at the expense of proper diagnostics on the new systems. Blackbeard shook as the first missile penetrated their countermeasures and detonated against the shields. Moments later, the schematic on Drake's console lit up with simulated explosions. Most of the hits struck them on the belly, where shields were weakest. Damn. 3 more flashes. Same exact place, right on the belly. He braced for shuddering explosions, alarms, and Jane's ominous assessment of damage. Nothing. They didn't seem to be hit. Then he realized those 3 flashes must have come from the new battery, installed on the ship's underside with the guns stripped from Captain Kidd. Of course, engineering may have incorporated the new guns and torpedo tubes, but Smythe hadn't yet reprogrammed the schematic. The computer was registering the firing of the guns as detonations. Explosions ripped into the side of the polar fort.
"Yes!"
Tolvern exclaimed. Drake called down to Barker. "Concentrate on the forward enemy batteries. We'll be swinging right past." He wished he could roll back and give the fort a full broadside, let them see the full might of a Punisher-class warship. But he needed to keep his shields up around the main batteries. Blackbeard was already taking blows right and left, testing her shields, so recently repaired. And something else was bugging him. It took a moment to register what. Where was the destroyer? The Navy warship was supposed to be either in orbit around Hot Barsa or patrolling the near space lanes. He believed it was HMS Javelin. She wasn't powerful enough to tackle a cruiser like Blackbeard on her own, but could provide devastating support fire. But there was no sign of her. Smythe hunched over his console, hands moving, his face bearing a look of intense concentration. He muttered something about pulse countermeasures, though whether to himself or through the comm to engineering, it was hard to say. Nib Pym was maneuvering them expertly, his eyes staring at his screen, while his long red fingers danced over the console. Cap sat next to him, also interfaced with the nav computer, running calculations in support. Tolvern kept in contact with engineering and fire control, her words coming as fast and punctuated as a Gatling gun. 2 more torpedoes slammed into the ship, but they didn't detonate. Either success for Blackbeard's countermeasures or a failure of the enemy armaments. The polar fort loomed. Blackbeard slid past. Missiles and cannon fire chased them down. The ship entered the atmosphere, shuddering and bucking. The fort continued to fire at them, but most of its weapon systems pointed outward into space. It was designed to repel Hroom sloops of war, which couldn't land planetside, but instead set up in orbit to bombard a planet. Drake's ship didn't suffer the same deficiency. But he was still going too fast, and at these speeds risked either skipping straight back into space again or slamming into the surface. Drake ordered the engines reversed. All was white on the viewscreen, and then suddenly they were below the clouds and into the purplish-tinted troposphere. They soared above the ocean, heading south, still at 90,000 feet elevation, but dropping quickly. A jagged coastal range appeared like a 500-mile-long row of granite teeth. The highest mountains soared to 20,000 feet or higher, but the world was so steamy that not even the tallest peaks were capped with snow. Then they were past the mountain range and still descending. A forest, blood-red and unbroken, stretched as far as the screen could show. No sugar plantations here. At first glance, this appeared to be primeval jungle, the land never cleared or cultivated. But beneath those towering red ferns, he knew, lay the vine-choked remains of a vast Hroom civilization. What Hroom remained labored to produce the sugar that continued to enslave their people. A missile streaked past. It detonated in the jungle and sent up a pillar of smoke and fire. Something struck the ship aft, making warning lights flash. Jane chimed her opinion for the first time, 11% damage to the deck shield. He could live with that, assuming the attack stopped. "Bring us down," he told Nib Pym. "Closer." Soon they were racing along only a few dozen feet above the crown of the highest trees. They hooked over another mountain range, this one not so rugged, with vegetation covering every inch of its surface.
"Tolvan," he said, "watch for that destroyer. Is she following?"
"Negative, sir. No sign that any ships have followed us into the atmosphere."
That made him suspicious, but they'd come in so fast that there was a chance that Javelin hadn't had time to enter the fight before Blackbeard was above the surface and out of sight. That didn't mean the naval warship wouldn't suddenly appear. Down near the planet's surface, the destroyer was a threat. The fortress is not so much. Since the forts were positioned to repel assault from space, they were poorly placed to scan the surface. Once Drake had the batteries retracted and cloaking fully online, a zigzagging course soon shook off the last few missiles and torpedoes chasing them through the atmosphere.
"I've located Malthorn's estate, sir," Smythe said. "It's 341 miles to the southwest, sending over the coordinates."
That close? That was better than he'd hoped, stabbing in blindly as they had. Even at subsonic speeds, they should get there in 45 minutes or so.
"Cap, you navigate us. Keep us below 200 feet.
"Aye, sir."
Drake thought about what he'd planned for when they arrived at Lord Malthorn's estate. May as well get Cap prepared now.
"Call Carvalho and Oglethorpe. Tell them to be ready for disembark with the assault team in half an hour."
"You want me to tell them?"
"Yes, you. The rest of you. Into the war room. You too, Smythe. You've been to the estate before."
That left Cap alone on the bridge as the other four filed their way into the war room. She was rubbing her hand on her scalp again, looking after them with a worried expression.
"Don't worry, if anything goes wrong, we'll be out in 2 seconds.
2 seconds is all it will take to crash," Tolvern muttered as the door closed on the war room.
Drake ignored her and told them all to sit.
"You are leaving her in charge?" Tolvern pressed. "Better hope you're right about Javelin, if we've got a destroyer on our tail and that escaped prisoner is the only one on the bridge."
"You told me yourself that there was no sign of Javelin," Drake pointed out.
"Yes, well."
"Cap will be in charge of the bridge while we are on the surface. Better get her used to the idea."
Nib Pym and Smythe gave Drake sharp looks.
"You're kidding," Tolvern said.
"Apart from engineering and gunnery duties," that's Barkus Bailiwick, "Cap will be calling the shots. At this point, we either trust her or we don't."
"Far be it from me to sound like a coward," she said. "But doesn't it make more sense to keep me on the bridge and send Cap in my place? Don't get me wrong, I'd rather be out there by your side, but I can fly the ship in a pinch, and Cap is a former Royal Marine. Seems to me that our positions on this mission are reversed from where they should be."
Drake laid it out bluntly.
"I want Cap and Carvalho separated. He's coming with us, so she stays behind."
"So you bring her and leave him? I'm not sold on Cap's reliability, but I trust her a lot more than that pirate. And if I stay behind, I can keep an eye on him. Don't tell me you trust him."
"Carvalho came to our aid during the spaceyard attack. But no, I don't trust him entirely. Not yet. I want him with me, not behind on my ship together with all the other riffraff he recruited on San Pablo."
Drake fixed Tolvern with a look that he hoped was both stern and sympathetic. "These are the options that remain, Commander." Her eyes flickered and she dropped her gaze. She was remembering her own role in this, he could see. Tolvern had set the original mutiny into motion, and while Drake no longer thought that had been a monumental blunder, given his new suspicions about Malthorn and the rest of the Admiralty, it wouldn't hurt for her to remember that these decisions had consequences, sometimes deadly.
"I assume there is a reason you've called us in here?"
Nib Pym asked in his soft, high voice.
"And it wasn't to tell us that you're leaving Ensign Cap in charge. Have you made a decision?"
"About the antidote? No, I still don't know what I'll do. We'll have to get our hands on it first, then I'll decide."
"I see."
Nib Pym's goal, Drake knew, was to distribute the antidote from one end of the sector to the other, freeing hundreds of millions, if not billions, of his fellow room from sugar addiction. And likely dooming Albion and the other human worlds as well, since they would lose their one advantage over the ancient alien race.
"We don't have much time," Drake said. "Less than an hour. How should we approach the Lord Admiral's estate?"
"Is there a need for strategy?" Tolvern said. "We land right in the middle of the estate and use the ship's guns to defend us as we approach the laboratories."
Is that possible?
Nib Pim said.
I thought there was a small airport, but no spaceport. Where would we land the ship? Maybe Smythe knows.
The tech officer looked up from his hand computer, blinking.
What? Oh, right. No, there isn't a spaceport, but I can't see why that matters. We'll burn up the tarmac or wherever we put her down, but we'll have no problem getting airborne again.
This was not new information to Drake, who had been turning over the details of their final approach for the past few days. The problem wasn't the condition of the airport.
Too conspicuous, he said. Landing so close to the manor house and other buildings would alert Malthorn security forces, and they'd send a distress signal. If Javelin finds us, she can bomb us from orbit. I'd rather land some distance off and make the final approach on foot. Get right in there before we are detected.
That will be tricky, Smythe said. Malthorn's estate is in the highlands where it's cooler. There aren't any sugar plantations around, or other flat, uncleared terrain, only jungle.
Nothing suitable? Drake asked. Not even a stretch of bare rock or gravel?
It's wet and warm and sunny, Smythe said. Every inch is covered with vegetation. We could burn out a landing zone, I suppose, pass over a few times with the plasma engines until we're sure we found a flat spot.
Drake thought for a moment.
Burning a landing zone will attract attention. Not the same as landing a warship in the middle of the estate, but someone will surely spot a big column of smoke and fire out in the jungle.
Could be that it helps us, Tolvern said. If the estate sends a few men to investigate, and we can thin their ranks before we approach.
Unless they're expecting us already, Drake said. If they've heard that a ship blasted its way past the forts, they might send a message to the fleet instead. Then we're back to facing the destroyer coming after us.
Doubt they'd be that alert, she said. Smythe said the estate is guarded by private security, not Royal Marines. Chances are they haven't heard anything about us. And even if they have, maybe they'd figure they can handle it.
Our plan can't rely on the incompetence of Malthorn's forces in order to succeed. She shrugged.
They're civilians. Incompetence is my default assumption.
Tell me about the Admiral's estate,
Nib Pim said to Smythe.
You said the manor and the outbuildings are built on some sort of platform. What kind of stone is this platform?
How do you mean? Smythe asked.
What color are the stones? How big are they?
Drake wasn't sure how this was relevant, but he was curious how the tech officer would answer the Froom's questions.
Smythe furrowed his brow. He'd been out on Malthorn's estate when the Lord Admiral had taken Dreadnought into the system, but he could be remarkably unobservant at times.
It depended on the situation. If it was computer equipment, software, or anything that could be assembled and electrified, Smythe remembered every detail. This was not one of those cases, and Drake knew that he would eventually come up blank.
"Didn't we already establish that this was a temple to the God of Death?" Drake asked the Froom. "Are you having second thoughts about that?"
"I want to be certain. It could be some other ruined structure the Lord Admiral used as his foundation. A temple to Liam Kar, the God of Death, is always built atop giant blocks of basalt to represent the sleep of death."
Drake didn't quite follow, nor did he understand how this detail mattered, but something in Nib Pim's voice made him press forward.
"Think, Smythe. Black basalt, is that what you saw?"
"Maybe, yes. There were vines and things growing from it where they hadn't been burned down, but that sounds about right."
"Only now I worry that I put that thought into your mind,"
Nib Pim said.
"Humans are susceptible to misremembering details."
"It was flat on top, I'm certain of that."
Smythe sounded more confident this time.
"And there was a steep staircase of dressed stone leading to the jungle floor."
"We're pressed for time," Drake cut in impatiently. "Is this important?"
"It may be, yes,"
the Hroom said.
"If it is a temple to the God of Death, then there will be a second smaller temple a few miles away, this one made of white marble, a temple to Liam Kar's brother, the God of Rebirth. They are always constructed in pairs and at a predictable distance."
"Would it be big enough to hold the ship?" Drake asked.
"I think so, yes. Nice and flat up top."
"Sounds perfect," Drake said.
"It should be easy enough to scan for it," Smythe said.
"We might be flying over the jungle looking for something that doesn't exist,"
the Froom said.
That seems risky, given the circumstances.
As is everything in this mission, Drake said. So we're all set. He rose. The three of you go to engineering and check gear. Make sure that the rest of the team is assembled and prepared. Damn if we only had a helicopter to bring us in the last few miles. But I suppose we'll have to do it on foot.
Where will you be, sir?
Tolvern asked. He tried to grimace and forced confidence into his voice that he did not feel. On the bridge, coaching Ensign Cap, as she brings us in for a landing. Chapter 4 Captain Rutherford of HMS Vigilant had pursued the Hroom frigate for 2 days from San Pablo. The alien ship had made several attempts to lose them, had made a feint toward one jump point, then tried to slink away toward a second while cloaked. Before attacking the Hroom space yards on San Pablo, Rutherford had seeded the system with detectors so he could get advance warning of a Hroom counterattack, and one of these caught the escape attempt. Rutherford continued his relentless pursuit. The Hroom was only an hour ahead of Rutherford's task force when it reached the second jump point and disappeared from the system. Rutherford sent an order for the other ships to run checks on their warp point engines in preparation to follow him through. Worried messages came back to him from the rest of the task force. Captain Harbrake on HMS Nimitz seemed especially concerned about stumbling into a trap. Harbrake was rubbing his hands together nervously when he appeared on the viewscreen, his big hound-dog eyes adding to the effect of a man who would rather be drinking a snifter of brandy in front of a peat fire on Albion than entering battle. A gentleman warrior. Only never mind the warrior part.
Are you sure this is wise, Rutherford? It's a Hroom system on the other side of that jump.
Nominally, Rutherford said. A few mining colonies overrun with sugar-eaters, practically abandoned. Slavers come and go at will. No, I don't think we'll be under much threat, and if we are, this fleet has more than enough firepower to respond.
But the next few systems have enemy naval bases, Harbrake whined. If the Hroom on San Pablo sent distress signals, that's about where the enemy would be by now. We might come out on the other side to find half the Hroom Navy waiting for us.
Good, I hope so.
Good? Captain Rutherford, pray let's not do anything hasty.
How could Harbrake be so craven? Anyway, that worry about the Hroom Navy was nonsense. Albion had extracted all manner of concessions after the latest war, and Rutherford personally knew, after fighting that final decisive engagement at Drake's side, that the Hroom Navy was decimated. They hadn't materialized another fleet or two in the past few months. Yes, good. Excellent, in fact. The Lord Admiral ordered us to destroy all enemy ships in the San Pablo system, Rutherford said, to prevent any from escaping should they make an attempt.
But they're no longer in the system. And anyway, it's only one little frigate, barely armed. Captain Crispin says, and I agree with him, that a more prudent course would be to return to the Barca system and resume the search for Captain Drake and his mutinous crew.
Harbrake continued with the excuses, but his words soon turned into a drone. The more excuses he gave, the less weight they carried. It sounded like cowardice, plain and simple. Rutherford let him go on for a few minutes before cutting him off. If you wish to send a message to the Lord Admiral to complain that we're pursuing the enemy too ruthlessly, go ahead. Perhaps Malthorn will elevate you to the flag officer of the expedition. Until then, we'll continue as ordered. Is that understood, Harbrake? A moment of silence as Harbrake looked back at him. A vein pulsed on the man's forehead, and his jaw clenched.
Yes, sir.
The screen went blank. Rutherford turned back to his console. There was nothing to do now except verify that the other ships in his task force, 2 cruisers besides Vigilant and Nimitz, plus 6 destroyers and 11 torpedo boats, were ready for the jump. It was a formidable force, and he was only short a battleship or carrier to make it the most powerful fleet he'd personally commanded. If any Hroom warships were dumb enough to be waiting on the other side, he would smash them to bits. Maybe he should have kept Harbrake on the screen for a few more minutes. The older officer's whining kept Rutherford's thoughts from returning to the battle at San Pablo. If one could call it a battle. He'd come into orbit around the planet and done a quick scan of both the human and the Hroom continents to search for Drake's ship,
which had supposedly been under repair in one of the space yards on the surface. Malthorn said the Froom continent. Rutherford had his doubts. Even more doubts when he finished the search. There had been no sign of either Drake or HMS Ajax. The Froom had detected Albion warships in the system in defiance of the recently signed treaty and sent protests. Rutherford dropped one of his destroyers into the atmosphere and buzzed it provocatively over the Froom cities. Someone foolishly fired a couple of missiles in an attempt to drive off the destroyer. That gave Rutherford his pretext, his cause juste. Rutherford had set up in orbit for 36 hours, bombarding the Froom cities with atomic bombs. He hadn't carried a large arsenal, a little over 50 small warheads, but he fired them all. When he was finished, the major Froom cities lay in smoking radioactive ruins. Protests came raging in from the Froom Empire before he'd finished, and even the human governor, some Ladino, had complained angrily, though his continent was protected from fallout by a wide ocean. Rutherford issued a curt response to human and alien alike. The Froom had attacked first. He had had no choice. Inside, he was twisting with anger that Malthorn had pushed him to this. It was a bloody ruse of a war is what it was. There had been nothing honorable in his actions. He hadn't come to San Pablo to track down a missing royal warship and bring its renegade captain to justice. He'd come to start a war. Upon leaving San Pablo, Rutherford had attacked and destroyed 2 Froom merchant ships and then set off in pursuit of a third. It had no armaments, was not even smuggling sugar. There was no reason to attack it except to follow orders. He was inclined to let it escape if not for his damn orders. If there was a massive Froom fleet on the other side of that jump, so be it. It was nothing more than he deserved. He almost wished such a thing were possible. Fighting real enemies would be a relief. The view screen chimed again with more communication from Nimitz. Harbrake was back, looking through with those droopy eyes.
"What the devil is it now?" Rutherford snarled. "If you're going to give me some rubbish about ambush, you coward, then I swear to God I'll—"
"It's about the jump formation."
Harbrake's voice was as tight as a twisted rubber band. "Oh, yes, of course. They couldn't go through the jump as currently arrayed. They had to funnel through the jump. And what's more, Rutherford should pull them in tight, so they all came in one after the other. His ships would be helpless for a brief moment on the other end as the crews fought through their jump concussions. Coming through quickly was safer, as more rapidly recovering ships would be able to give cover to their slower counterparts in case there was, in fact, an ambush waiting." Rutherford looked around his bridge. Commander Pitsfield was staring at him, wide-eyed over the outburst, while the pilot was frowning down at his hands. The tech officer blinked from his console, looking awkward. Harbrake glared in barely concealed fury from the viewscreen. His eyes didn't look so much like a hound dog's now, and he didn't seem particularly craven either, more like he was on the verge of challenging Rutherford to a duel. Rutherford wrestled his anger to the ground. It was that old rage coming through, and once again he'd nearly snapped. He'd humiliated Harbrake in front of his inferiors, both here and on Nimitz. That was an inexcusable breach of etiquette for an officer and a gentleman. Rutherford's father was a baron on the Zealand Islands back on Albion, but there had always been rumors of commoner blood in the family tree, and at moments like this, he wondered if it were not true. Otherwise, how to explain his lack of self-control? The moment called for an apology. "I beg your pardon, Captain. I spoke hastily, and perhaps I'd begun to question the wisdom of dismissing your counsel." He couldn't bring himself to do it. "You are right, Harbrake." That was all he could manage, and he almost choked on that. "Calypso and Vigilant will take the vanguard. Then we'll bring the destroyers through, followed by the torpedo boats. Finally, the last 2 cruisers, Nimitz and Richmond, will emerge with main batteries at the ready. The rest will enter the jump point with all shields up." Harbrake gave a curt nod and killed the connection. Rutherford stared at the screen as it resolved itself to a split display of the 2 destroyers flanking his ship. He took a deep breath and forced down the residual anger at Harbrake and the other captains. These were the men Malthorn had given him. He had no choice in the matter, so he had better start trusting them if he was going to challenge the Froom closer to their core systems. Warp engine checks passed for the entire task force, and Rutherford gave orders for the final acceleration to the jump point. The ships pulled into line, one after the other, a few hundred miles apart, which was almost the same as touching at these speeds. The computer gave the 3-minute warning. Commander Pitsfield passed this warning through the general comlink.
3 minutes to jump. All crew seated and secured.
Vigilant was the first ship. So much time on a straight course, first in pursuit of the Hroom frigate, and then racing toward the jump point. Now they had arrived.
30 seconds to jump, the computer warned. 10 seconds.
A pause.
5 seconds.
Then they were through. Entering a jump point was not like falling asleep, but exiting the other side felt a lot like waking, except as if from a blow to the head, not a restful nap. 1 minute you were here, fully conscious. The next, you were there, fighting to consciousness. Rutherford shook his head, groggy and stunned. A dull throbbing came from a spot behind his left eye, and more throbbing in the back of his head. He blinked, trying to remember for a long moment where he was and what he was doing. Lights were flashing, voices speaking in his head. His brain emerged from the fog like a computer booting up, the most critical information coming online first. Jump point. Vigilant. Task force. Enemy ship.
Captain!
Someone said.
Captain, are you there?
It was Pitsfield's voice. The commander sounded slightly more alert than Rutherford felt. Pitsfield was pointing at something. The view screen. Rutherford was almost fully alert now, and the headache was already fading. This was not the trips. It wouldn't even be a particularly severe jump concussion. Not for him. His eyes tracked where Pitsfield was pointing. An enemy sloop of war filled the view screen. Chapter 5. The first breath of Hot Barsa's atmosphere felt like a hose had been shoved into Drake's mouth and steam pumped into his lungs. Blackbeard sat hissing behind them as a warm drizzle fell onto the steaming hot surface. The vines and other vegetation atop the temple platform lay smoking, leaves withered, dead birds curled on their backs with their leathery wings crisped. Carvalho bent and picked up something that looked like a long blackened eel, but with the appendages of a giant centipede.
Snakes with legs. How weird is that?
Put it down, Tolvern told him. This isn't a nature walk.
Look at your hands,
one of his mates told the Ladino when he tossed it aside. The woman gestured with the muzzle of her assault rifle.
That yellow crap, what is it?
Carvalho made a disgusted sound when he saw the slimy yellow liquid that had come off the dead snake and wiped his hands on his pants. Several of the others laughed at him. A harsh, jeering cry from some bird or animal sounded from the jungle, and the laughter died. Drake took in the dozen members of his team, who stood gaping at the forest of red ferns that grew around the temple platform on which they'd landed. More of the strange, leathery birds flew overhead, and insects the size of a man's fist buzzed past like little helicopters.
"Garcia, Thatcher, Mora, take the perimeter," Drake said. "You see anything funny, you warn Ensign Cap on the bridge. Let Blackbeard's deck gun settle it. Don't you try to fight it out."
"You mean make a perimeter up here?"
Thatcher asked in a low, nervous voice. He was one of the men who'd recently joined the crew on San Pablo, and at the moment he looked as if he were regretting the decision.
"Up here?" Tolvern scoffed. "What good would that do? You need a vantage that the ship doesn't have."
She pointed to a pile of rubble that had tumbled from one corner of the temple platform.
"Get down there and set up a lookout. Go!"
The three men moved tentatively toward the steep staircase that led to the jungle floor. Drake glanced up at the sky. It had a maroon tint from the surface, and the sun was dull and hazy through the clouds, but scorching hot nonetheless. No sign of enemies in the sky. He knew the Navy would be searching, but it was a big continent, and unless they'd been tracked, the search could take days. He didn't intend to be here that long. Once Drake was satisfied that they were alone, he led the remaining members of the assault team down to the jungle. Garcia, Thatcher, and Mora were hacking 6-foot fern fronds to act as camouflage for the lookout he'd identified. The men moved tentatively along the edge of the jungle, as if expecting a tiger to leap out of the brush and drag them away. But the others glanced longingly in the direction of the three lookouts. Everyone but the three men in question knew that theirs was the safest part of the whole expedition, here within the protective fire of Blackbeard's deck guns. The rest of the team had to slog through the unknown dangers of the forest and approach the rather better understood dangers of Malthorn's estate. Smythe consulted his computer, then pointed. "It's this way." Drake eyed the nearly impenetrable growth ahead of them, all vines and brush and ferns, with 6-foot stalks. "It seems thickest in that direction," he said. "Perhaps if we go south for a stretch until we get past the worst of it, we could hook back around again."
"I'm showing a ravine and a river that way," Smythe said. "That isn't necessarily a problem," Tolvern said. "We might be able to follow the riverbank."
"You'll want to stay away from the river,"
Nib Pim said. The Hroom was the only non-human in the dozen people who'd come out of the ship, and the only one who wasn't panting in the tropical heat and humidity.
"What is it, those crocodile things you see on San Pablo?"
one of the men asked.
20-foot eels, actually," Nib Pim said. "But they're not confined to the river. They can walk on their fins and come onto the bank to hunt. Some species hunt in packs."
Tolvern shuddered.
20-foot eels that hunt in packs. We'll stay away from that, thank you very much."
Drake wasn't so sure. What were giant eels compared to firearms? But the human members of his team already looked spooked by their surroundings, excepting Carvalho, who had squatted to look at a strange, segmented bug-lizard thing crawling by his boot. He seemed fascinated by the strange world. The rest of them looked ready to scramble up the stairs to the ship. Some fierce pirates they had turned out to be.
"Anyway, this direction is the shortest," Smythe continued,
wiping the moisture from his computer screen.
"Some hard slogging, then we'll hit the main estate road. We can follow that straight to the laboratories."
There didn't seem to be an alternative other than picking up the ship and landing right next to the Lord Admiral's manor house, which Drake had already ruled out. "We'll go 2 by 2, he said. "The last 3 together. Front pair will take turns cutting a trail." In addition to their firearms, the remaining 9 members of the assault team had come armed with cutlasses, sabers, and machetes. They set into the jungle with a few tentative hacks, but as it started to give way, they picked up the pace. The vegetation was perhaps less woody than Terran plants, and cut easily, but it was so dense that it took time to forge a path. They made slow but steady progress toward where Smythe said they would find the road. A few minutes later, they reached a flat, sandy patch of ground that had been stripped of vegetation.
"You will want to keep an eye out for lurkers when we cross bare patches,"
Nib Pim said.
"Look for their dens." "What the hell is a lurker?"
one of the men asked. Drake actually knew this. The animal was found wherever Hroom lived. Picture a giant lizard with 6 legs that lives in a burrow.
"That doesn't sound so bad," Tolvern said.
She wiped at the sweat on the back of her neck.
"How big are we talking when you say giant?"
"The size of a lion," he told her. "And venomous. They nest in colonies."
"King's bulls,"
she cursed.
"I beg your pardon, sir." "Hold up," Smythe said. "My map lost its bearings. I think someone is jamming our connection with the satellite mapping system." "You want us to hold up?" Tolvern said. "Here?" "I'm not trying to," he protested.
"Are there pouncers in these jungles too?" Drake asked Nib Pim.
"Undoubtedly. Hroom have lived on this planet for 1,000 years. You'll find pretty much everything here that you'd find on any of our worlds."
"What is it with you people and recreating your natural ecosystem?"
Tolvern asked. She was kicking at the ground as if trying to uncover lurker dens.
"Humans do the same thing," Nib Pim said. "Your settlers bring old earth livestock and pets everywhere you go."
"Sure, but we aren't in the habit of transplanting our vermin." "Here it is," Smythe said. "This way."
On some worlds, vast flocks of goats and sheep have turned grasslands into deserts, the Froom countered as they set off again. And you carry rats and mice wherever you go.
Not on purpose, Smythe said, looking up from his computer. Right, Commander? Why would you transplant man-eating lizards? But Tolvern seemed to have tired of the conversation, and she came up with Drake, who was taking a turn with the machete. He needed a break from the chatter, but didn't mind his commander's company.
Let me go next, she said.
Didn't you have a go already?
Only for a few minutes.
Smythe had stopped again to study the computer, and Drake leaned on the machete and looked Tolvern over. Sweat soaked her tank top, showing more of her body than he was used to seeing. She had strong arms and legs, with a lean figure.
"Why, Captain," she said lightly, "I don't usually catch you checking me out."
"As per fleet regulations, I avoid ogling my junior officers."
"I was joking," Drake smiled.
"So was I."
Curiously, she blushed, or maybe that was just a flush from the heat. He turned discreetly away to let her regain her composure, even though he was unsure why he'd left her embarrassed. He hadn't said anything improper, only light banter. To be safe, he should clear up any misconceptions.
"I was only looking you over to see if you seemed tired," he said. "You know that, right?"
"I'm sorry, sir. Cap was teasing me earlier, and I might be overly sensitive at the moment."
"Teasing you about what?"
"About being sweet on you."
"That's ridiculous."
"I know," Tolvern said quickly. "Here, give me that."
She snatched the machete and began hacking at the ferns ahead of them, swinging away madly as if to prove that she still had energy to spare. Drake stared after her, dismayed, as she began to disappear into the growth, until shortly he could see her primarily by the shaking ferns. What had gotten into her? This heat was making people crazy. The sooner they got to the road, the better.
"Actually," Smythe spoke up, "it's this way we want to go."
He pointed in a different direction from where Tolvern was going. Drake sighed.
"Commander, you're going the wrong way. Hello?"
The hacking sound stopped.
"Yeah, I heard you,"
came her disgusted voice from the vegetation some 15 feet or so ahead of him. Suddenly, Tolvern cried out. Her shout was followed by a piercing bird-like shriek, and then a gunshot. Another shriek. Drake unslung his rifle at Tolvern's cry and waded after her. He lowered his shoulder and bowled through the broken, oozing vines and fronds. He came upon his first mate lying beneath some animal that resembled a giant hairless cat with scales. It had a short, toothy snout, and its legs were wrapped around Tolvern. At first glance, it looked as though she was struggling as it tore into her, but the thing was motionless and bleeding from its head. The struggles were Tolvern's attempts to shove the dead body off her. Drake helped Tolvern get free, even as she insisted she was fine and could take care of herself. She stood up and pawed at a slimy yellow liquid oozing down the side of her face and neck. It was the same substance that had covered Carvalho's hands when he'd picked up the dead snake. Some kind of blood, apparently. Drake used his water to wash it off. Others pushed their way in. The first to arrive was Nib Pim. His red, mottled skin blended in with the vegetation. He looked down at the creature with his big, liquid gaze.
"That answers the question about pounces," he said.
Nib Pim and Carvalho were at the front of the column when they hacked free of the undergrowth and found the estate road. They called for the captain, and Drake pushed his way up to take a look. A gash of muddy red soil cut through the jungle. The vegetation on either side was scorched, wilted, as if it had been burned as it encroached, but already there were red tendrils creeping out in an attempt to reclaim the narrow strip of cleared land. Muddy ruts pocked the road, hovered over by swarms of insects with metallic green and gold wings. Drake pulled the team back into the protective cover and radioed the ship. Cap answered.
"Everything okay, Captain?" she asked. "Those blokes on the perimeter said they heard a gunshot."
"We're fine. Some creature tried to eat Tolvern and she shot it."
"What about Carvalho? He's been careful, right? If that big lug..."
"Ensign," he interrupted.
"Sorry, sir. What is it, sir?"
We're down in the weeds and running blind. What are you seeing out there?
Nothing. No sign of the destroyer. And we ain't getting shot at from the forts neither. Got a figure they're stirred up out there. But they don't see us. At least it don't seem so.
And the estate?
Can't spot it from here. Sensors aren't picking up anything, but that don't mean much, seeing as we're in the middle of the jungle and all.
I figured as much, Drake said. You see or hear anything funny, anything flying overhead, for example, you let me know.
He cut the link. The call had been a risk, as would any future communication, but the success of his plan relied on Malthorn's men being ignorant of their presence. Assuming he was right, and the forts hadn't warned civilians on the planet, there was no reason that estate security would be scanning for illicit communication. They were stepping tentatively onto the road when the rumble of an engine caught their ears. Drake ordered them back into the vegetation. A lorry rolled by a few seconds later, the tires hitting ruts and kicking up muddy water. Drake peered through a break in the vegetation and spotted two men with assault rifles sitting in the back, perched atop crates of supplies. Cigarettes dangled from their lips. The lorry itself was driven by a Hroom with the pale pink skin of a sugar-eater. Drake waited until the lorry was gone before he poked his head back out and listened. No more vehicles, only the incessant buzz of insects and the distant screech of birds and animals. Smythe pointed in the same direction taken by the departing lorry.
That way to the manor house and labs.
They made quicker time on the road, but the downside was that it was an open highway for insects. The things buzzed past their heads, landed in their hair, and came in to lick at their sweat with long, hummingbird-like tongues. It may have been the highlands, but they were on some sort of plateau, and the ground was mostly flat, except for occasional hillocks that flanked the road on either side. On one of them, a fern the size of an oak tree had come loose and fallen atop other ferns in the jungle below, and where it had broken from the hillock, it had exposed the edge of a wall made of cut stone. It occurred to Drake that all of these hillocks might be buildings or temples. He glanced at Nib Pim to see his pilot watching him.
"There was a large city here once," the Hroom said.
"How big?"
"Roughly the size of York on your homeworld."
Drake could see now that the land was dotted with ruins beneath all that vegetation, but it was still hard to picture. Not so much that a Hroom city had been populated by millions. Alien cities of that size still existed on those planets where the Empire had not yet collapsed, but that after only a few generations, the jungle had so completely reclaimed it. One of the men screamed from the back of the column. It was Oglethorpe, the former Special Forces fellow who'd transferred to the gunnery when his left shoulder was messed up in combat. He was spinning about madly, reaching around with his good arm to claw at something on his back. Tolvern swung her rifle butt at his shoulder blades, and Oglethorpe went down. He groaned and rolled onto his belly. Drake hurried back. A dead insect as big as a crow was attached to Oglethorpe's back by a proboscis the size of a drinking straw. Tolvern's blow had ruptured the creature's belly and spilled out a mix of yellow and red blood. The latter, apparently, what it had sucked from Oglethorpe's back. Its wings still fluttered. Tolvern yanked it off and boot-stomped it until it stopped moving. They helped Oglethorpe to his feet. He looked at the dead insect and shuddered.
"What the hell is that?"
"A mosquito," Smythe said.
"That's a bloody mosquito,"
Oglethorpe cried.
"King's balls."
"That's what passes for them around here," Smythe said grimly. "I told you they're all over the place."
"You also said it wasn't mosquito season," Tolvern said.
"It isn't."
"What do you use for mosquito netting out here?" Drake said, still disconcerted to see so much of Oglethorpe's blood smeared into the ground. "Razor wire?"
"Keep moving,"
Nib Pim said.
"Oglethorpe's blood will attract more of them."
That was enough, and they redoubled their pace. But it didn't earn them respite for long, and soon they were facing more of the ugly blighters. Being vigilant, they were generally able to scare the things off, but one of the bugs circled relentlessly as people flailed, its long, scissor-like proboscis probing the air. The company was more terrified of the mosquito than they had been of lurkers and pouncers, and if Drake hadn't stopped them, they would have fired their rifles wildly into the air in an attempt to bring it down. Finally, the mosquito buzzed off, and most of the other bugs vanished over the next several hundred yards as well. A pungent smell soon filled the air. The road passed over a rusty iron bridge that crossed a ravine filled with muddy, fetid water. Below, creatures with large, bulging eyes broke the surface to study them before disappearing again.
"Are those the eels?" someone asked nervously.
"No," the room said. "It's something else you don't want to meet."
"Come on," Drake said.
There was green, earth-style vegetation on the other side of the bridge, and he was anxious to reach it. First came tall stalks of grass, then fields of herbs. That was what he'd smelled on the bridge, followed by a second bridge and ravine. "This is the buffer zone," Smythe said. "The strong-smelling herbs and the ravines are meant to keep out the bugs. Doesn't always work. The land is perfectly adapted for Hroom vegetation and animals, not Terran. Anyway, don't leave the road. The ground is mined."
"Look, Captain," Tolvern said. "The guard post."
Drake had already spotted it. Standing right in front of the second bridge, the post was a squat little building made of the same blocks of cut stone that had formed the side of the exposed ruins they'd seen earlier. There was a lorry parked next to it, but it wasn't the vehicle that had driven by them on the road. As they approached, a man drew open a rain-streaked window to peer out at them, and two more guards came out of the building, one human, the other a Hroom. Both were armed. These two aimed their rifles at the newcomers, and the man inside the bunker shouted a challenge. Chapter 6. Captain Rutherford shook off the jump concussion as he stared at the Hroom sloop of war. It was shaped like a long, smooth submarine with a 50-foot spike at the end. The tube-like shape of the ship helped with cloaking, and the spike on the end was heavily shielded, allowing the sloop itself to be used as a ram. That spike could split a small ship in two, or puncture straight through a larger double-hulled vessel to open a huge gash in the main decks. Hroom pilots had an uncanny ability to charge in for close-quarters combat, and the ramming tactic had been effective in earlier wars. But during the reign of Queen Ellen, Albion's research labs had developed superior shielding, and since then, when a Hroom sloop rammed a larger ship like a cruiser or a battleship, the spike tended to break off and vent the Hroom bridge and its officers into space. In the face of such technological countermeasures, the Hroom might have been expected to alter their warships accordingly, but the Empire was in long-term decline, and most of their warships were decades out of date.
"Lower shields," Rutherford ordered. "Present tubes 1 and 2. Main battery at the ready. Are Nimitz and Richmond through yet?"
Pitsfield turned slowly from staring at the viewscreen. His eyes had a glazed expression like he was drunk or had suffered a concussion.
"What?"
Rather than waiting for the fool to pull out of it, Rutherford thumbed on the comlink to give the orders himself. He had to repeat them before he got a response from the gunnery. Meanwhile, he braced for an attack from the enemy's guns, grateful that there was only a single sloop of war protecting the frigate Rutherford had chased out of San Pablo. The frigate stood at a distance of several thousand miles, shielded behind the sloop. It had come to a halt, as if intending to act as spectator for the pending battle. What fools! A single sloop wouldn't stop Rutherford for long, and then he'd be after the merchant frigate again. Unless there's a bigger fleet on the way. That was a worrying thought, but he put it out of his mind for the moment. He had his hands full with the sloop. So far, it was not firing. Neither did it attempt to flee. It stood with its main guns presented, and its serpentine missile batteries exposed. At this close range, the bomblet swarms would be devastating. Messages started coming in from other ships of the fleet as officers and crew recovered from the jump. Everybody wanted to know if they should shoot. Rutherford sent orders to prepare all appropriate weapon systems, but held off the order to open fire.
"McCormick," Rutherford started to say, before remembering, with a scowl, that Admiral Malthorn had replaced his tech officer with Norris, who had proven himself competent enough,
even if Rutherford didn't trust him under the circumstances. "Excuse me, Norris. Hail the enemy ship, see what they want."
"And what if they act belligerent?" Pitsfield asked. "Do we open fire? Are we at war or not?"
"Yes, Commander, I know. That's what I'm trying to decide." "The sloop is not responding, sir," Tech Officer Norris said. His fingers moved along his console. "In fact," he began, a frown spreading. "Yes?" Rutherford said impatiently. "What is it?"
"I think it's dead."
"What do you mean?"
The tech officer amplified the enemy ship on the view screen. At range, it had appeared strong and deadly, perfectly positioned to blast whatever came out of the jump point with all available weapon systems. Upon closer inspection, Rutherford saw that a line of holes perforated the hull from bow to stern, as neat as needle stitches. Each hole was small, not bigger than a man's head, but there were dozens of them.
"King's balls!"
one of the other ensigns on the bridge exclaimed, and Rutherford glared him into silence before turning back to Pitsfield.
"What kind of weapon leaves that mark?"
Rutherford asked. Pitsfield looked bewildered.
"Nothing I've ever heard of."
"Norris, do a more thorough scan and send your findings to engineering and the gunnery. Maybe someone there knows something. Commander..."
"Oh, for God's sake!"
Rutherford interrupted himself as a thicket of urgent messages kept coming through to his console. In addition, three fleet officers were trying to hail him on the comlink. He took a moment to look over the messages in case someone had found something useful. No, most were still making excited noises about whether or not they should attack. Rutherford sent out a general notice that amounted to "shut the hell up already and let me think." When that was done, he started over with Pitsfield. "Commander, send a destroyer to harpoon that merchant frigate and bring her in. If she tries to run, destroy her. Otherwise, I want to talk to her captain." "Is the sloop a derelict? Maybe it has been out here for a while."
"Negative, sir. Her engines are still warm. Impossible to say how long ago this happened, but certainly within the past few days."
Norris was still studying the results of his scan with a deepening scowl. "There are at least 100 holes in the outer hull, sir. More than a dozen go straight through."
"Attacked from the outside, right?" Rutherford asked. "It couldn't be the result of an internal explosion?"
"Definitely from the outside. But here's the curious thing. The room shields are still intact. Whatever went through did so without disabling them first."
That was both strange and alarming. No Albion weapon had done this. Rutherford had never heard of such a thing, and his forces were the only ones anywhere near the system. Could the room be testing a new weapon system? Something that would make hash of Albion shields? He imagined his own ship with those neat holes. Vigilant would be as structurally sound as a sugar cube dipped in hot tea. No, that didn't make any sense either. If the Froom had such a weapon, why would they test it on a perfectly good warship, what amounted to one of their main ships of the line, and test it here, where it might be seen by the enemy? What's more, the engines were still hot. There must have been crew on the ship.
"Scans are showing dead bodies on board," the tech officer added, confirming what Rutherford had already guessed. "And I heard back from engineering. They're baffled. They're running a few scans of their own, but right now nobody knows anything."
The only other possibility Rutherford could think of was a Froom civil war. Seemed unlikely, especially given the unknown weapon system. But what was the alternative? Maybe the frigate captain had seen something.
"Sir," Pitsfield said, "the destroyer has harpooned the frigate and is bringing her in. But look at these images."
The commander split the view screen and showed the merchant frigate from the destroyer's perspective as the harpoon dragged it in for capture. A neat row of holes ran along the side of the frigate, most of them punching from one side to the other. The merchant had shared whatever fate had befallen the Froom warship. Rutherford's mouth went dry. The merchant frigate had only been an hour ahead of his task force when she jumped through. Whoever had done this was close at hand. He finally dropped his gaze to his blinking console and sorted through the latest messages. Most were easily dismissed, the requests of captains and commanders unable to think for themselves. But one of the 8-man torpedo boats, under command of a young lieutenant,
by the name of Catherine Cates, had detected the wake of an unknown ship. Rutherford got her on the comm. He didn't know the woman, but she spoke with the accent of a West Canadian, not too far removed from how they spoke in the Zealand Islands where he'd grown up. There was something trustworthy in that accent, not like all these people from Britain that Malthorn had saddled him with. "The wake is fresh, sir," Cates said. "At least two different ship signatures, though it's hard to tell for sure." She sounded young, and the accent might have been trustworthy, but the female voice didn't inspire confidence. Rutherford would never have promoted a woman to command even such a small ship as a torpedo boat, not when there were no doubt more deserving men in the fleet.
"Room or human?" he asked.
"I couldn't say for sure. There's something odd about the signature. Requesting permission to reconnoiter and take a closer look."
"Very well. You're attached to Nimitz. She has better instruments, but you may attend her in escort."
"With all due respect, sir, Captain Harbrake is perhaps too cautious. Time is of the essence."
"I see your point. Let me find one of the destroyers to lead you."
"We can accelerate faster, sir, traveling alone. Every moment we wait makes it less likely that we'll find anything useful."
It was borderline insubordination, but Rutherford was pleased to have someone finally show initiative, so he let it pass.
"Very well. Go take a look, but do not engage with any enemies. Is that understood?"
"Yes, sir."
Cates was gone. Yes, quite a bit of initiative, in fact. A commodity in precious short supply. Maybe this once he should overlook her gender in favor of results. Time would tell. Word came through from the captured frigate a few minutes later, confirming that there were no survivors on board. Meanwhile, Calypso had harpooned the Froom warship and was bringing it in as well. Rutherford doubted that the larger ship would have survivors either, but he wanted to make a closer inspection of the sloop's shields to see what had left all those perforations. But no sooner had a boarding party entered the captured ship than an excited message came through from Captain Linzel of Calypso. The warship had a number of dead Froom floating in the vacuum of space after the ship had lost its air and antigrav. But when Linzel's bosuns began cutting away a segment of the destroyed ship's hull, they'd stumbled over an undetached escape pod. Inside were two survivors. They'd apparently been trapped for some time and must have witnessed the entire battle. Better yet, both of them spoke English. Not 20 minutes later, Rutherford had the Froom aboard his own ship and restrained in the brig. There was no word yet from Kate's expedition in her torpedo boat, and by now Rutherford was desperate for answers, so he went down to personally see to the interrogation of the prisoners. The two Froom were dehydrated, feverish, and above all, raving for sugar, which nobody had yet provided. Rutherford had no intention of sending them into a swoon where he would be unable to extract anything useful, so he ordered them dragged to their feet while the interrogation continued. The Froom begged, threatened, screamed. It was all so much babble that he was about to give up and leave them to their guards, when one of the Froom lurched against his restraints, eyes bugging. He strained toward Rutherford. Spittle flew from his mouth.
"Apex! We'll kill you all!"
Chapter 7.
"Follow my lead," Drake told the other members of the assault team as they approached the two guards in the middle of the road. One of the guards was human, the other Froom, but they both seemed alert and suspicious.
"Nobody act tense. Don't lift your weapons."
Subterfuge wouldn't have been necessary if he meant to kill the guards. The pair in the road could be cut down in 2 seconds, and while there was a third guard inside the building, the man had carelessly opened the window to study them, rather than peering through the water-streaked plastisteel. They were just doing their job, and Drake would rather not kill them. It must be tedious to guard the road for day after day against smugglers and free Froom rebels, and it had made them careless. The two humans had the look of young guys just out from Albion, maybe former Marines, now turned private contractors, come to Hot Barca, spend a couple of years in the sweltering heat to save a few hundred pounds to take back home, to buy a little house, get married, or whatever. The Hroom was an eater, that was evident from the pale pinkish skin, but there was no need to kill any of them. What's more, if Drake could grab them quickly, they wouldn't have a chance to radio a warning to the rest of the estate. Drake and the others sauntered toward the post as if they'd passed this way a dozen times before. The man with the rifle squinted suspiciously through small, pig-like eyes and cast a quick glance at the third member of the guard post, the man leaning out the window, then looked back at Drake.
"Who are you?"
"We work for the Lord Admiral," Drake called back. He kept his tone commanding and made no attempt to disguise his upper-class accent. "We were driving up from the lowlands when the lorry broke down, hit a rut and broke an axle a few miles back." The man's eyes widened slightly as soon as Drake began to speak, and he looked suddenly nervous to be confronting someone of obvious breeding. Nevertheless, his tone was insolent and suspicious.
"Yeah, is that so?"
"That's right, and I don't have time for your attitude. I've got a report to make." Drake kept walking. "Do you have a working comlink? Ours went out."
"Hold it right there!"
The man lifted his gun, and the Hroom followed his lead. Drake and his companion stopped. They were still 20 feet distant. So much for the hope that they'd saunter up and get into the guardhouse before these three woke up.
"A vehicle passed through here 5 minutes ago," the man in the road said. "They didn't say nothing about armed blokes coming up the road behind them, let alone that someone was broken down and needed help." "And I would like to know why," Drake said, his tone peevish. "We tried to flag them down. They didn't so much as slow their lorry."
"Yeah," Tolvern grumbled next to him. "What's up with that? Is this a no-hitchhiking zone or what?"
"Maybe they thought we were lurkers," Drake said. "They looked terrified enough."
"Probably afraid of mosquitoes is all," she said. "You see those guys in the back flailing at the bugs?"
The man at the window snorted, and even the Hroom smiled at this. Some of the suspicion faded from the eyes of the man who'd been questioning them. Drake was dripping with sweat. The sun was the hammer and the humid air the hot tongs that had squeezed their bodies of liquid. Not one of them had more than a mouthful of water left in their canteens. But it wasn't only the sun making Drake sweat now. "Don't be idiots," he thought. "I don't want to kill you."
"You can use our comlink," the guard said at last. "But what the hell are you doing out there? There's 9 of you, all armed, and you aren't on our list of arrivals."
Drake had given this some thought on their approach, and the lie came easily to his lips.
"Like I said, we work for Malthorn. We're trying to put down the insurgency in the lowlands. You know the Free Hroom attacks? Over the last week we've been chasing a band into the highlands. We think they might have a base up here somewhere."
"Never heard of them in the highlands," the man said. "They generally stick to attacking the plantations. Well, I guess that's good enough. You can use the comm."
Drake started to step forward, waving his hands at his companions to follow. A few more steps, and they'd be up to the wide-open door of the guardhouse. A quick command, and they'd have these three prisoners.
"They're lying," the Hroom guard said unexpectedly.
He hadn't spoken a word to that point, and Drake had paid him little attention, figuring that the alien's thoughts would be turned to his next sugar ration.
"Shut up," his companion said good-naturedly. "We don't need to know everything going on out there."
The Hroom stared at Nib Pym, who was in the middle of Drake's team, Carvalho and Hawes, but hardly inconspicuous being over 7 feet tall. This one facing them was shorter, but still tall. But the thing that set him apart was his light pink, almost white skin, the color not so different from a red-headed human with a sunburn. The hue was almost nothing like Nib Pym's skin, now almost completely returned to its natural pigmentation. Even before the Hroom spoke, Drake knew what he would say.
"He's not an eater, he's a Free Hroom."
The alien kept his gun pointed at Drake's chest.
"Big deal," Tolvern said quickly. "We're from Albion, and we don't need permission from you to bring a Free Hroom to Hot Barsa."
"Hold on, he's right,"
the human guard said.
"Why would Malthorn send a Free Hroom down to fight Free Hroom? What kind of idiots do you—"
A gunshot. The Hroom guard's head jerked backward, and bits of brain and blood sprayed out. Drake threw himself to the side as the surviving guard in the road lifted his weapon. Drake came up shooting, even as bullets zipped past his head. His weapon joined others in gunning down their opponent. In seconds, both guards lay dead in the road. But getting the final man was a different matter. He'd pulled back inside the guard box at the first shot and shoved the window shut. A second, smaller slit opened below, no wider than the barrel of the gun that now thrust through. A spray of gunfire splattered the road. One of Drake's companions cried out, but he didn't turn to see who had been hit. Instead, he squirmed forward on his belly until he got a good angle on the guardhouse door, which was still open. Tolvern came up beside him and took a knee. He hiked himself up so he'd be in better position.
"I'm going in," she said.
"No, shoot at the door. He'll come to close it."
The rest of his team were blasting away at the building, and chips of stone went flying. But they couldn't get into the guardhouse, and even had a hard time suppressing return fire from the solitary enemy inside. Tolvern fired twice through the open door, then waited. An arm came out to grab for the handle. Drake took aim and shot it. A cry of pain. The arm jerked back inside. Suddenly the guard was shouting,
"Help! I'm under attack!"
He must be on the comm.
"They killed the others! I'm the only one!"
Drake and Tolvern sprang to their feet and sprinted for the open door. They came through to find the remaining guard sitting with his left hand mashing down a button on the comlink and his right cradled in front of him, bleeding. His gun lay on the floor. As they entered, the man looked up at them with a wild, panicked expression.
"For God's sake!"
It was unclear if the man was demanding help from the estate or pleading for mercy from the attackers. But Drake couldn't wait for more information to reach his enemies. He lifted his gun and finished it. Drake was down a man after the attack on the guard post, or more precisely, a woman. Her name was Silva, and she'd been one of the new crew from San Pablo. Silva had volunteered to go with the away team, and her short, muscular body seemed well suited for the mission. But nobody seemed to know much about her, not Carvalho, who had recruited her, nor any of the others who'd joined them in the sweltering spaceport on San Pablo. After a quick inspection proved that no more enemies remained inside the squat guard building, Drake glanced at Silva's body, sprawled on the road, her mouth and eyes open to the bruised sky as the drizzle splattered across her face. One hand still gripped her rifle, which Carvalho now pried loose. A white scar stretched across the dead woman's palm from her index finger to the corner opposite her thumb. It looked like a scar from grabbing a blade in a fight, which reminded Drake that Silva was a woman with a history, an individual.
"Get her into the guard building," he ordered. "I won't leave her out here to be dragged off by animals."
After additional thought, he added, "Get the dead guards inside, too. They deserve the same." Drake turned over his options. His first choice was to simply call the estate headquarters and say no worries, everything was under control. Bluff that he was one of the guards. But given the final frantic communication from the guard post, that would hardly be believed. Instead, Drake thought he might get someone on the comm and embellish the story. They had been attacked, the guards' two companions killed. By whom? By animals. Yes, some wild pack of something had come out of the brush, crossed the first bridge, and ambushed the other two guards. Before this thought could clarify itself, the telltale rumble of a lorry engine reached his ears.
"Take cover," Tolvern said. "We've got company."
Where to take cover was the real question. The guard post sat on an island of sorts between two ravines. There were no trees or rocks behind which to hide, only ankle-length grass with sharp serrated blades. They could take cover in the guard post, but that would be exactly the place to draw attention from the arriving vehicle. Then they'd face another firefight, and perhaps not come out on top this time. If instead Drake could get his forces across the second bridge, they could perhaps gain the trees on the estate side. But the bridge was a good 100 feet wide as it crossed the ravine. If the lorry reached the bridge before they got across, they'd be exposed, with nowhere to run. The expedition would come to a swift and inglorious end. Drake eyed the ravine beneath the bridge, and that gave him an idea.
"Down below, quickly!"
Few people seemed keen on this plan, for it meant descending the muddy slope toward the sluggish water below, and they were no doubt thinking of giant eels. To punctuate this worry, Something big swirled below the surface of the water as they approached the edge of the ravine.
"I'm not going down there," Hawes said in a nervous voice. "Them eels are down there. Maybe crocodiles, too."
"It's bullets you should be worried about," Tolvern said. "Now move it."
With encouragement from the braver in the group, they scrambled down the muddy slope, then moved along the bottom of the ravine to get some distance from the bridge above. They flattened themselves against the muddy side and waited. The buzz of insects filled the air, but it was soon overpowered by the approaching rumble of the lorry.
"Listen to me," Drake said, his face pressed into the mud. "The water can't be more than 10 feet wide."
"Don't tell me we're swimming across," someone said.
The rumbling engine was growing louder. It had been long enough that Drake now wondered if they might have crossed the bridge in time after all, but there had been no way to be certain.
"Listen up," he said. "The lorry will go straight to the guard post. It will take them a minute or two to puzzle out what happened. By the time they figure it out, we'll be on the other side. And yes, we're going to swim."
"What about the eels?" Tolvern said. "I hate to sound nervous, but..."
"That wasn't an eel,"
Nib Pym said.
"Looked more like a crocodile."
"Wonderful," she said.
"You're being ridiculous, all of you," Drake said. "Forget the gunfire, the guards trying to kill us. What's got you terrified is the thought that an overgrown lizard has crawled into this little puddle."
He was about to assure them that they'd be across in 2 seconds, but then the lorry came bumping and coughing over the bridge. Nobody spoke or moved. Drake didn't so much as turn his head to look up. If they were spotted, if one of these men above happened to look down instead of across to the guardhouse, Drake and his companions would be mowed down before they had a chance to lift their weapons. Then the lorry was gone and rumbling to a stop by the guardhouse.
"Up, everyone," he said in a harsh whisper. "Go."
Nib Pym was already entering the water and waded to the other side without swimming. It came up to the tall Hroom's shoulders, though, and others were forced to paddle with their weapons and gear held above the water until they were scrambling, terrified, out the other side. They didn't hesitate, but went clawing and fighting up the slope to the grass and trees above them. Drake waited until all the others were either on the opposite side or in the water before entering. He was halfway across, his boots shoving off the mud at the bottom as he paddle swam, when Tolvern looked back at him as she gained the bank and let out a squeak. She pointed, gaping, toward the water. It churned, and a knobby, scaly snout broke the surface. Drake lunged forward. He caught Tolvern's outstretched arm and hauled himself on shore. She grabbed for her gun.
"Don't shoot!"
he shouted. Instead, she dragged out her saber. Water dripped off the end. Drake felt something at his back as he rose and drew his machete. He turned to see an enormous snout lunging for him. Not so much like a crocodile, but like a long, sharp beak with opposing, slicing horns on the front for shearing. Tolvern swung her blade as the scaly monster snapped for Drake's legs. The blade caught it across its snout, and it twisted, snarling, to take her instead. Drake hacked at its scaled belly with all his strength. Its skin was hard, but he'd caught the thing right beneath its foremost clawed leg, and it hissed and snapped at the machete. It fell back into the water with a thunderous splash. Drake was sure that all the noise would have alerted the occupants of the lorry, but as he joined the last of his comrades, he could hear the guards shouting to each other about what had happened at the guardhouse. It was too distant to pick out distinct words. Drake's team hid in the brush, and somehow he wasn't surprised that even this Terran vegetation hid vermin, biting ants, and enormous wasps. Carvalho brushed into a stinging plant and soon had a rash. The climate seemed tailored to encourage unpleasant, biting, stinging things. But nobody complained. It was better than the crocodile with the monstrous turtle-like beak. They were still hiding in the brush above the ravine when the lorry came back across a few minutes later. Drake supposed they'd left some of the guards behind at the post, but it was hard to say what they were thinking at the estate. Maybe the estate thought it was a quick raid, or maybe they were fully alert. Could be that Drake had made a mistake in leaving Silva's body behind, or maybe that had successfully confused Malthorn's people. When he determined it was safe to move again, Drake looked around for Smythe, who he discovered hunched miserably a few feet away. How long until the woods thin out? The tech officer wiped his computer screen on the back of his pant leg and peered down at it.
A quarter mile, more or less?
Good, let's move out, Drake told the others. Stick to the trees. He glanced back into the ravine a final time before they left. Two eyes emerged from the water and looked up at him. He caught a glimpse of the long, horny snout, and some 15 feet away, the tip of the thing's tail. Then it submerged again. Tolvern stood by Drake's shoulder, looking down.
Some planet, huh?
About this Hroom rebellion, he said. Maybe we should let them have the place. Keep their crocodiles all to themselves. She raised an eyebrow.
What, that little thing? I thought you said it was just an overgrown lizard.
Chapter 8. They suffered no more misadventures as they approached the heart of Admiral Malthorn's estate. Once they emerged from the jungle and passed the security on the perimeter, the grounds took on the appearance of a country estate on Albion, albeit with sharp-bladed grass infested with biting ants. The tropical trees dripped with moss, looking nothing like the stately oak and maple of the Drake estate in the Zealand Islands. Mounds rose here and there across the grass, some only a couple of feet high, but others 10, 20, even 30 feet tall. More overgrown ruins, apparently, and Drake was reminded that there was an entire Hroom city buried beneath his feet. Once there had been elevated rail cars, twisting skyscrapers, and vast ziggurat-like temple complexes. The trees grew thicker for a stretch, and they followed an overgrown trail for several minutes before the woods thinned to present a view of the heart of the estate, which sat on a grassy hill several hundred yards from their position. Tolvern passed Drake the binoculars, and he took a closer look. The hill seemed to be a flat platform, like the one where they'd landed Blackbeard, only several times the size and height. A road twisted in three switchbacks to reach the top of the platform. Two large buildings sat up top across a flat expanse. Lorries parked in front of the buildings to the left, and people were moving about up there, although from this distance it was impossible to tell if they were armed, or even if they were human or Hroom. A traditional manor house sat to the right of these buildings, the sort that fine gentlemen and ladies had been building for 1,000 years, since the days when the peerage of Old England built them across the breadth of their small island home. Drake had seen many of the fine manor houses on Albion, and it wasn't until he glanced away that he realized how ridiculous the house looked here on a distant world, squatting atop the temple platform of some ancient alien god. The Lord Admiral didn't even live here. Did he ever come? Even in the Highlands, the climate was rarely pleasant, and it was a backwater. When Malthorn was on shore leave, he would surely stay at his home estate, where he would be surrounded by others of rank and privilege. The buildings to the left looked nothing like the manor, rather they had the appearance of warehouses or factories. What were the dark things out front by the lorries? They looked like the broken shell plates of a giant beetle. He handed the binoculars back to Tolvern and asked her opinion.
"Looks like a ship's hull," she said.
Drake took them back. Yes, of course. A ship's hull broken into pieces. He could see it now.
"I guess we found Henry Upton," he said. "Or what's left of her?"
"May she burn for the eternities," Nib Pym said, his voice hollow. "And if her captain and crew survived, let them die badly."
Drake glanced at his pilot, surprised to hear the Hroom curses coming out of his mouth. In addition to being maledictions of a sort, the phrases also indicated a certain religious sense, and Drake had never taken his pilot for one who held to traditional Hroom beliefs. There was an old Earth saying about atheists and foxholes, and he supposed the same would hold for a Hroom who'd been a sugar-eater carried off to slavery. Smythe took a turn at the binoculars.
"That's them, that's what we're looking for. The laboratory's on the left. The other building is a factory."
He handed them back. Drake took a closer look at the people moving about in front of the laboratory. They seemed to be armed gunmen hurrying toward the manor house. No doubt Drake's forces were the cause of the alarm. but whatever steward lived in the house in Malthorn's absence must not comprehend the nature of the threat. Armed attackers had overrun one of the outer guardhouses and disappeared. That much was apparently known. That the target was the laboratories, rather than the manor house, was not.
"Smythe, you said you can jam the security perimeter?" Drake asked.
"Working on it now, sir."
"How long?"
5 minutes, maybe a bit longer."
"Quicker would be better." Drake turned to the others. "Carvalho, Hawes, go to the edge of the woods and find a better view of the estate. See if you can see around that ship wreckage, and tell me what's behind it. I need to know what we're dealing with here."
He dialed through to the ship, hooking Tolvern in on the call.
"This is the captain. We've found the laboratory and we're going in."
"Are you okay?" Cap asked. "We heard more shooting. Sounded like a bloody firefight."
"We had an incident getting in, lost one person. But now we're on to the estate."
"Who was it?"
The ensign's voice was tight.
"It wasn't..."
"No, it wasn't Carvalho. It was Silva. There will be time for that later. I need you to listen."
Drake told her to recall the three men he'd left to guard the perimeter and make sure the ship was ready to go. Keep the engines warm. He'd soon need Cap to bring Blackbeard in for an extraction.
"Got it?"
"Aye, sir."
She still sounded distracted.
"Be careful, all of you."
"No messing around. I want you in here, all guns blazing on my command."
He ended the call and turned to Tolvern, who had been listening to the whole thing.
"You see, that's why I wanted Cap and Carvalho separated. That's why naval regulations forbid fraternization with fellow officers."
He glanced to where Carvalho and Hawes had gone, some 50 yards off now.
"It puts us all at risk, puts the mission itself at risk. No one person's life is favored over another's."
"Except yours, sir."
"What?"
"Your life, Captain. That's the one life we protect at all costs."
He gave her a sharp look.
"Not in battle, you bloody well don't. In battle, every life is equally important."
Tolvern nodded, but she looked unconvinced. In any event, now was not the time to squabble over that kind of nonsense. Cap's evident worry about her lover vindicated his decision to separate them and reminded him to be more vigilant about preventing any more such attachments among the crew.
"Got it, sir," Smythe said. "Defense matrix is down, cameras offline."
"What about the landmines?"
"They're down too. At least, I think so."
"You think so?"
"Yes, sir," Smythe said, more confidently this time. "They're offline."
Tolvern got back on the comm and recalled Hawes and Carvalho, who came trotting up moments later with intelligence. There was a helipad, a helicopter, and more men with guns behind the wreckage of Henry Upton.
"Good to know," Drake said. "Ready? Let's go."
He led the eight of them, walking at a swift pace out of the woods, across the wide expanse of lawn, toward the temple platform. The helicopter lifted into the air when they were halfway across, its rotor thumping loudly in the thick tropical air. It loitered for several seconds above the platform, and Drake braced himself for it to come swooping toward them, firing its guns. But then it dipped its nose and thumped to the west toward the guard post. He had to assume that the crew had spotted the armed party crossing the grounds. But then why hadn't they flown over to investigate?
"That was me,"
Smythe said smugly, in answer to Drake's unspoken question. He'd kept his nose at his handheld computer. "I sent a false message that the rebels had been spotted escaping into the jungle west of the guard post."
"Excellent. Whatever else you can do to sow confusion, do it."
"I'm now sending a message purporting to be from a group of guards patrolling the grounds. That would be us, in case we've been spotted. We haven't found anything and are returning to the temple platform." "Will it work?"
Tolvern said.
"It should."
Smythe didn't sound as sure of that as Drake would like. Nevertheless, the tech officer had already proven invaluable. It was taking longer to cross the open lawn than expected, and Drake hadn't fully considered that having the estate perched atop a temple platform meant that defenders would have a long, wide view of their approach. Their success depended on deception. A few minutes later, they reached the base of the enormous temple and the road that cut its way to the top in a series of switchbacks. A lorry came rumbling down toward them. It was the same vehicle that they'd spotted on the jungle road, hauling freight up from the lowlands. Drake motioned his people back to let it past,
and gave a casual wave to the driver. "My God," Tolvern said in a low voice as they got up. "Careless idiots. They're going to let us just waltz in there, aren't they?" But it was not to be. As soon as they reached the top of the platform and turned toward the doors of the laboratory complex, a second lorry came across. It slowed as it approached.
"Kilcup wants you at the manor," the driver began. "He..."
The man stopped.
"Who the hell are you?"
Drake had by now glanced into the lorry and saw that the driver was alone. Drake pointed his gun through the open window.
"Don't make a move."
The driver mashed down on the gas. Drake fired. Bullets filled the cab. The lorry lurched, drifting, as the driver slumped over the wheel. Tolvern ran and caught up with it, opened the door to drag the man out, and jumped into the driver's seat. She brought the lorry to a halt, and the rest of them piled in, with Drake up front with Tolvern, and the rest in the back. The gunshots had brought unwelcome attention, and guards turned toward them. Shouts, gunfire. Tolvern swung the vehicle around and mashed her foot on the gas. She shifted, and they raced toward the laboratory complex. She came tearing in, then slammed on the brakes and brought them jerking to a halt. They jumped out shooting, exchanging gunfire with two men coming out the front doors to investigate. The men fell, but more gunfire lashed at them from behind, knocking out the tires and pinging off the side of the vehicle. Half the team, led by Carvalho, moved as if to set up a perimeter behind the lorry, so the others could assault the building itself.
"No," Drake ordered. "Take position behind the wreckage."
The blackened hull of Henry Upton still lay in pieces to one side. As damaged as it had been by Drake's attack, it would still provide far better shielding than the lorry, which could be cut apart by a heavy machine gun. The four men moved quickly to obey. The remaining four members of the assault group, Drake, Tolvern, Nib Pym, and Smythe, burst through the doors and into the facility. They found themselves in an open foyer, the air blessedly cool and dry after the muggy jungle. The sound of gunfire continued muffled from outside. Drake eyed the hallways leading in opposite directions, the staircase climbing from the foyer to a mezzanine level above them.
"Talk to me, Smythe. Where do we go?"
The tech officer glanced up from his computer. "Up the stairs, and then down the hallway." There didn't seem to be any guards left in the labs themselves, but there were plenty of people working inside. As soon as they reached the mezzanine level, Drake ordered two men in lab coats taken as prisoners. They begged not to be killed. Moments later, a woman poked her head curiously out of her office, as if drawn by the shouts of her co-workers. Drake forced her at gunpoint to join the party. So close to their target now, Nib Pym seemed anxious to race ahead, eager to get his hands on the sugar antidote, but Drake insisted on caution. They cleared each room and corridor as they moved deeper into the building. He hoped Carvalho and the others were